It is Tuesday, November 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, U.S. President Donald Trump offers resolve on the North Korean nuclear crisis. Iran denies a Saudi claim it launched a missile from Yemen, and we'll hear how ancient Psalms speak to a modern audience. It's all ahead. U.S. President Donald Trump Tuesday condemned North Korea's nuclear and ballistic missiles weapons program.
North Korea is a worldwide threat that requires worldwide action.
During a news conference in Seoul with South Korean President Moon Jae-in, Trump said it is unacceptable that nations would help arm and finance the regime of Kim Jong-un. VOA White House correspondent Steve Herman is traveling with President Trump. Speaking from Seoul, he tells me about Trump's remarks on North Korea.
He is expecting strong support not only from China, but also countries such as Russia and European Union members to really put full pressure from the international community on Pyongyang to hopefully make them stop developing their nuclear weapons and their ballistic missiles. But Pyongyang has shown no overt signs of caving into this pressure, although the president seemed to hint today in his joint appearance with the South Korean president, Moon Jae-in, that there had been some indication, some movement by North Korea that was encouraging. And he wasn't ruling out dialogue totally. But the message that we've heard from the White House, and also this was expressed by Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe alongside President Trump in Tokyo on Monday, is that we can't just have dialogue for dialogue's sake. And of course, President Trump is extremely critical of past deals made with North Korea and believes that, as he says often about the trade deals that the United States has signed, that they were weak agreements.
Well, and President Moon told Mr. Trump during talks at the Blue House that he hoped that this visit will serve as a turning point in resolving the North Korean issue.
Right. He didn't specify what in particular lead to that. There was a lot of talk about improving the defense relationship between the two countries. Of course, the United States has a significant number of troops and military aircraft and naval ships in the area at all times to defend South Korea against North Korea. And also the United States has South Korea as well as Japan under its nuclear umbrella. And with all this talk of war recently, I think that the words that President Trump has expressed, especially here in South Korea, have been meant to sort of relieve some of the anxiety, especially among the people of South Korea who fear that President Trump might launch some type of preventive or preemptive strike against North Korea. And of course, South Korea would be the country that would most pay the price for any retaliation from North Korea.
Well, and President Trump has another chance on Wednesday because he will be addressing the South Korean National Assembly.
Yes, and the president at a banquet this evening made a bit of a cryptic remark saying that there may be some sort of a surprise. And we have really no idea what he may be announcing, and we'll just have to wait and see. But the president has hinted, even in the past couple of weeks, when he was asked if he was going to go to the DMZ, and he hedged about that, although officials here say he's definitely not going to the demilitarized zone. But the president said that everyone would be surprised. So we are expecting some kind of announcement by President Trump during his speech to the National Assembly.
Should be an interesting day ahead for you. All right. Thank you so much for speaking with me.
My pleasure, Sarah.
VOA White House correspondent Steve Herman reporting from Seoul, South Korea. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's trending?
Well, Sarah, it is a big day here in the United States. It is Election Day. People are heading to the polls across the country, and so we see hashtag Election Day, hashtag I voted, both trending on social media. People are posting photos of their ballots or the very popular stickers, because you get a sticker when you vote that says I voted.
I voted, yes.
Everybody likes to take a picture of that to prove that they voted and to get other people out to vote. Many people are urging friends and family and their social media followers to get out and vote, using last year's presidential election as evidence why every vote matters and why turning out to the polls can really have an impact. Now, this is an off-year election. There's no presidential election. Of course, that was last year. There's no congressional elections. That's next year. But there are a number of local races drawing attention. In fact, there are more than 100 million Americans who have state or local elections happening today. Things like the mayors of New York City, Boston, Atlanta, and Miami all up for election, re-election. Two governor's races as well in the states of New Jersey and Virginia. They have those off-year elections. Now, Virginia, just over the river from our VOA headquarters, is of particular interest to political prognosticators on social media. It's considered a swing state, no strong allegiance to Republicans or Democrats. Hillary Clinton won the state by about 5 percentage points last year, but it's said to be a preview of the congressional elections next year. The theory is that if the Democrats win, it could spell trouble for President Trump and his Republican Party as they fight to maintain control of the House of Representatives and the Senate. If the Republicans win, it could show that the president is unpopular and weighing down the party. So a lot of eyes on these local races today.
All right. Thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. A television station is attacked in the capital of Afghanistan. The U.S. denounces Venezuela after the pro-government legislature targeted opposition leader Freddy Guevara. Kenya's election season is extended as three petitions are filed in court. And President Trump said stricter U.S. gun laws would not have stopped the massacre in Texas. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists in Chile have found a new heart failure treatment that uses umbilical cord-derived stem cells may lead to remarkable improvements in heart muscle function and quality of life for those suffering from this condition. The American Heart Association says heart failure means that your heart isn't pumping blood as it should and is unable to keep up with the body's need for blood and oxygen. Heart failure is usually treated with medication and changes in lifestyle. The researchers found that a year after heart failure patients were given this new treatment, they showed a significant and continued improvement in their heart's ability to pump blood and had an improved quality of life. They also found the treatment was safe with no adverse effects. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, a new production in New York showcases biblical psalms. Iran on Tuesday denied claims from the Saudi Arabian crown prince that Iran committed a direct military aggression against Riyadh when Yemeni rebels launched a missile at a Saudi airport. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif, while speaking with British Foreign Minister Boris Johnson, called the allegations by Saudi Arabia contrary to reality and dangerous. Earlier Tuesday, Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, also speaking with Johnson, accused its arch rival of potentially committing an act of war after the Saudis intercepted the missile fired at King Khalid International Airport Saturday. The Saudi coalition fighting the Shiite Houthi rebels said Monday it has closed all air, land, and sea ports in Yemen to stem the flow of Iranian arms to the Houthis. University of San Francisco politics professor and chair of Middle East Studies Stephen Zunis tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, Saudi Arabia has been rife with corruption given its vast wealth and tight political, economic, and social control by one extended family.
But this purge, while the targeted people may or may not be guilty of various corrupt practices, does appear to be more political in nature. It's an effort of Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, to basically get rid of any potential rivals prior to his coming ascent to power. Traditionally, the Saudi royal family has had some degree of checks and balances within various factions. But these purges have led some people to suspect that the ambitious crown prince may be eyeing a more direct, personless rule than we've seen from previous Saudi monarchs.
Are we seeing a new period of autocracy in Saudi Arabia?
Well, it's always been autocratic, but the style of autocracy, if you will, from a collective oligarchic kind of structure to one that is concentrated within a smaller group of people around the crown prince, could definitely indicate that we're looking at perhaps a more modern form of authoritarianism.
President Trump, on his trip in Asia, tweeted that they, referring to King Salman and the crown prince, know exactly what they're doing, adding that some of those they are harshly treating have been milking their country for years.
That indeed may be the case, but there are, of course, many other people, both in Saudi Arabia and among other allies, that have been milking their respective countries with little objections from the Trump administration. In many respects, what we are seeing in Saudi Arabia may be more comparable to Putin's so-called anti-corruption purges a few years ago, going after various Russian oligarchs who may indeed have been guilty of corrupt practices, but whose major sin was not going along with Putin's agenda. And this may indeed what we're now seeing in Saudi Arabia.
You now have Saudi Arabia tightening its grip over Yemen. You also have rising tensions with Hezbollah, the Iranian-backed political force in Lebanon, and you have a missile fired from Yemen towards Saudi Arabia. Are we seeing a new level of tensions between Iran and Saudi Arabia?
Tensions are certainly up between Iran and Saudi Arabia, though it's unclear how much Iran really has to do with the recent developments. The Houthis are allied with factions of the former Western-backed dictator Saleh, and many parts of the army allied with Saleh have joined the Houthis. Given the enormous amount of arms that have been flowing in that country from various places, the fact that outside the United States they have more guns per capita than any country in the world, the Houthis really do not need Iranian armaments to do the fighting.
Stephen Zuna said it would be tragic for Lebanon, still rebuilding from its 15-year civil war, to be once again dragged into political chaos by the tug-of-war for regional influence between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Scientists are calling for renewed efforts to develop a vaccine for one of the biggest causes of stillbirths and infant deaths worldwide. An estimated 1 in 5 pregnant women around the world carries group B streptococcus bacteria, and most show no symptoms, but it can prove deadly for unborn and newborn babies, especially where traditional treatments such as antibiotics are unavailable, as Henry Ridgewell reports.
Group B streptococcus bacteria can be passed to an unborn baby in the womb or to newborns during labor. Left untreated, it can cause other serious infections, such as meningitis and septicemia. Out of about 410,000 cases every year, there are at least 147,000 preventable stillbirths and infant deaths globally. Professor Joy Lawn of the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine co-led the research.
That's a very conservative estimate because, in fact, in most of Asia, there is very limited data around group B strep or indeed any infectious causes of stillbirth.
The prevalence of the group B strep infection varies globally, ranging from 11% in Eastern Asia to 35% in the Caribbean. The United States also has a relatively large number of infections, but the number of child deaths varies according to the treatment available.
It's not the same as, you know, many conditions that we look at around the world, which are only in poor countries. But if we look at the continent that has the biggest number of cases and particularly the biggest number of deaths, that's Africa.
At least 60 countries have a policy for antibiotic use in pregnancy to tackle infection, including the United States. But in Africa, health systems can rarely afford to screen or treat group B strep. As well as the prohibitive cost, doctors say giving antibiotics to the estimated 21.7 million pregnant women carrying the infection may contribute to antimicrobial resistance, a major global health crisis. Again, Professor Lorne.
So this new evidence that we're publishing really pushes much more clearly the urgent need for a maternal vaccine to prevent Group B strep. We must be intentional from the start that that vaccine is able to reach the poorest, and especially in Africa where the burden is highest.
At least four vaccines are in development, but none is expected to be licensed for at least 5 years. Until then, the researchers say health systems should continue to treat Group B strep using antibiotics where possible. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. Bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is International Edition. The Hebrew Psalms are among the Bible's most widely read verses and have inspired composers for thousands of years. And New York's Lincoln Center is presenting a festival of choral settings of all 150 Psalms by 150 different composers, including nine U.S. premieres. It's called the Psalms Experience, as Jeff London reports.
The 150 poems in the Book of Psalms represent a range of human voices and emotions, and they've been a source of solace and inspiration for generations.
Although they are 2,500 to 3,000-year-old texts that were written by our ancestors, they are about the here and now.
Tito Visser, the music director of the Netherlands Chamber Choir, had the idea to create a series of 12-hour-long concerts featuring every single psalm. He teamed up with Lincoln Center to make it happen. Each concert is centered on a theme, says Visser: justice, faith, gratitude, lamentation.
These psalms are about refugees, they are about unrighteous leaders, they are about abuse of power, so they are incredibly timely.
Four choirs from around the world are singing music from the 12th century to today. Pulitzer Prize-winning composer Carolyn Shaw was commissioned to write music for Psalm 84, which begins, "How beloved is your dwelling place, O Lord of hosts."
I really identified with it because it has to do with finding a home and finding a refuge and a place and sort of celebrating the sense of safety, but also there's a yearning for a home that feels very relevant today.
Shaw says she was thinking of Syria as she wrote it.
And the second verse is, "The sparrow found a house, and the swallow her nest, where she may place her young," which is just a beautiful image of, you know, a bird trying to keep her children safe, people trying to keep their families safe.
Oh,
meant to be sung.
That's another Pulitzer Prize winner, David Lang, who set Psalm 101.
One thing I really like about the Psalms is that they're sort of like a catalog of all the different ways that you can have a conversation with God. So some of them are very hopeful and some of them are very lamenting and some of them are very full of praise and really sort of like every way you can imagine talking to God. This one seemed the one that was most like a negotiation.
Writing choral music is not easy, says another composer commissioned for the project, Mohammed Farouz.
Because it requires a certain commitment to simplicity. There's nowhere to hide. The counterpoint's very, very exposed. It's sort of like the Oval Office has no corners, you know?
And in these difficult times, conductor Tito Visser hopes audiences will get some comfort, contemplation, and community.
I truly believe that there's one amazing thing about choral singing, and that's the fact that it unites people.
For VOA News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
Lovely music. Well, that's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Signing solidarity with the Cuban people, the United States voted against an annual United Nations resolution condemning the U.S. embargo on Cuba. The resolution was adopted by the General Assembly, with 191 countries voting in favor and two, the United States and Israel, voting against. U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations Nikki Haley said the Cuban regime uses the yearly U.N. debate on the U.S. embargo as political theater, a distraction from the destruction it has inflicted on its own people and on others in the Western Hemisphere. Ambassador Haley said, as long as the Cuban people continue to be deprived of their human rights and fundamental freedoms, as long as the proceeds from trade with Cuba go to prop up the dictatorial regime responsible for denying those rights, the United States does not fear isolation in this chamber or anywhere else. Our principles are not up for a vote. She pointed out that those principles are not only enshrined in the U.S. Constitution, but also in the Charter of the United Nations. In her remarks to the General Assembly, Ambassador Haley spoke directly to the Cuban people. She noted that many were hopeful after Cuba and the United States, under the previous administration, opened diplomatic relations between the two countries. What you probably don't know, she said, is that your government responded to this gesture of goodwill not by joining in the spirit in which it was offered, but by expanding its politically motivated detentions, harassment, and violence against those who advocate for political and economic freedom in Cuba. Your government silences its critics, Ambassador Haley declared. It disrupts peaceful assemblies. It censors independent journalists and rigs the economy so the government alone profits. Ambassador Haley emphasized that the American people fully support the Cuban people's dreams of living in a country where freedom of expression is respected and leaders are freely chosen. The United States opposes this resolution today in continued solidarity with the Cuban people and in the hope that they will one day be free to choose their own destiny, said Ambassador Haley. When the day of freedom comes for the Cuban people, and it will come, we will rejoice with them as only a free people can.
That was an editorial reflecting